The means by which we navigate the world, Daniel Kahneman's systems 1 and 2, rely on our perceptual systems, intuition, memory, and cognition, with all their ticks, warts, biases, and flaws. Each of us is an astounding bundle of perceptual and cognitive abilities, coexisting with the seeds of our own undoing. When it comes to learning, what we choose to do is guided by our judgments of what works and what doesn't, and we are easily misled. Our susceptibility to illusion and misjudgment should give us all pause, and especially so to the advocates of student-directed learning, a theory now current among some parents and educators. This theory holds that students know best what they need to study to master a subject and what pace and methods work best for them. For example, at Manhattan Free School in East Harlem, opened in 2008, students, quote, do not receive grades, take tests, or have to do anything they do not feel like doing. The Brooklyn Free School, which opened in 2004, along with a new crop of homeschooling families who call themselves unschoolers, follows the precept that whatever intrigues the learner is what will result in the best learning. The intent is laudatory. We know that students need to take more control of their own learning by employing strategies like those we have discussed. For example, they need to test themselves, both to attain the direct benefits of increased retention and to determine what they know and don't know to more accurately judge their progress and focus on material that needs more work. But few students practice these strategies, and those who do will need more than encouragement if they are to practice them effectively. It turns out that even when students understand that retrieval practice is a superior strategy, they often fail to persist long enough to get the lasting benefit. For example, when students are presented with a body of material to master, say a stack of foreign vocabulary flashcards, and are free to decide when to drop a card out of the deck because they've learned it, most students drop the card when they've gotten it right once or twice, far sooner than they should. The paradox is that those students who employ the least effective study strategies overestimate their learning the most, and, as a consequence of their misplaced confidence, they are not inclined to change their habits. The football player preparing for next Saturday's game doesn't leave his performance to intuition. He runs through his plays and mixes it up to discover the rough edges and work them out on the field well before suiting up for the big game. If this kind of behavior were anywhere close to the norm for students in their academics today, then self-directed learning would be highly effective. But of course, the football player is not self-directed. His practice is guided by a coach. Likewise, most students will learn academics better under an instructor who knows where improvement is needed and structures the practice required to achieve it. The answer to illusion and misjudgment is to replace subjective experience as the basis for decisions with a set of objective gauges outside ourselves so that our judgment squares with the real world around us. When we have reliable reference points, like cockpit instruments, and make a habit of checking them, we can make good decisions about where to focus our efforts, recognize when we've lost our bearings, and find our way back again. Here are some examples. Tools and habits for calibrating your judgment. Most important is to make frequent use of testing and retrieval practice to verify what you really do know versus what you think you know. Frequent low-stakes quizzes in class help the instructor verify that students are in fact learning as well as they appear to be, and reveal the areas where extra attention is needed. Doing cumulative quizzing, as Andy Sobel does in his political economics course, is especially powerful for consolidating learning and knitting the concepts from one stage of a course into new material encountered later. As a learner, you can use any number of practice techniques to self-test your mastery, from answering flashcards to explaining key concepts in your own words and to peer instruction. Don't make the mistake of dropping material from your testing regime once you've gotten it correct a couple of times. If it's important, it needs to be practiced and practiced again. And don't put stock in momentary gains that result from massed practice. Space your testing, vary your practice, keep the long view. Peer instruction, a learning model developed by Eric Mazur, incorporates many of the foregoing principles. The material to be covered in class is assigned for reading beforehand. In class, the lecture is interspersed with quick tests that present students with a conceptual question and give them a minute or two to grapple with it. They then try in small groups to reach a consensus on the correct answer. In Mazur's experience, this process engages the students in the underlying concepts of the lecture material, reveals students' problems in reaching understanding, and provides opportunities for them to explain their understanding, receive feedback, and assess their learning compared to other students. Likewise, the process serves as a gauge for the instructor of how well the students are assimilating the material and in what areas more or less work is needed. Mazur tries to pair students who initially had different answers to a question so that they can see another point of view and try to convince one another of who is right. For two more examples of this technique, see the profiles of the professors Mary Pat Wenderoth and Michael D. Matthews in Chapter 8. Pay attention to the cues you're using to judge what you have learned. Whether something feels familiar or fluent is not always a reliable indicator of learning. Neither is your level of ease in retrieving a fact or a phrase on a quiz shortly after encountering it in a lecture or text. Ease of retrieval after a delay, however, is a good indicator of learning. Far better is to create a mental model of the material that integrates the various ideas across a text, connects them to what you already know, and enables you to draw inferences. How ably you can explain a text is an excellent cue for judging comprehension, because you must recall the salient points from memory, put them into your own words, and explain why they are significant, how they relate to the larger subject. Instructors should give corrective feedback, and learners should seek it. In his interview with Errol Morris, the psychologist David Dunning argues that the path to self-insight leads through other people, quote, "So it really depends on what sort of feedback you are getting. Is the world telling you good things? Is the world rewarding you in a way that you would expect a competent person to be rewarded? If you watch other people, you often find there are different ways to do things. There are better ways to do things. I'm not as good as I thought I was, but I have something to work on," unquote. Think of the kids lining up to join the softball team. Would you be picked? In many fields, the practice of peer review serves as an external gauge, providing feedback on one's performance. Most medical practice groups have morbidity mortality conferences, and if a doctor has a bad patient outcome, it will be presented there. The other doctors will pick it apart or say, "You did a good job, it was just a bad situation." Mike Ebersold argues that people in his field should practice as part of a group. Quote, "If there are other neurosurgeons around you, it's a safeguard. If you are doing something that's not acceptable, they'll call you to task for it." In many settings, your judgment and learning are calibrated by working alongside a more experienced partner. Airline first officers with captains, rookies with seasoned cops, residents with experienced surgeons. The apprentice model is a very old one in human experience, as novices, whether cobblers or attorneys, have traditionally learned their craft from experienced practitioners. In other settings, teams are formed of people with complementary areas of expertise. When doctors implant medical devices like pacemakers and neurostimulators, of the type that treat incontinence or the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, the manufacturer has a product representative right in the operating room with the surgeon. The rep has seen many surgeries using the device, knows the kinds of patients that will benefit from it, knows the contraindications and adverse events, and has a hotline to the engineers and clinicians on the company staff. The rep tracks the surgery to make sure the device is implanted in the correct position, the leads are inserted to the correct depth, and so on. Every part of the team benefits. The patient is assured of an appropriate and successful surgery. The doctor gets product and troubleshooting expertise at her fingertips, and the company makes sure its products are used correctly. Training that simulates the kinds of demands and changeable conditions that can be expected in real-world settings helps learners and trainers assess mastery and focus on areas where understanding or competency need to be raised. Take police work, where many different forms of simulation are used in training. For firearms training, it's often video-based scenarios, with a large screen set up at one end of a room, where a number of props have been placed to imitate the situation confronting the officer, who enters the scene armed with a gun that has been modified to interact with the video. Lieutenant Catherine Johnson of the Minneapolis Police Department describes a couple of such simulations in which she has trained. One was a traffic stop. The training room had the screen at one end and objects around the room, a big blue mailbox, a fire hydrant, a doorway, that you could use for cover in dealing with what was happening on the screen. I remember walking toward the screen and the video simulating my coming up to the car as I did that, very realistic, and suddenly the trunk popped up and a guy with a shotgun rose out and shot me. Which to this day, every time I go up to a car on a traffic stop, I push down hard on the trunk to make sure it isn't open. And it's because of that one scenario in the training that I went through. Another firearm simulation was a domestic call, and it starts where I'm approaching the residence and there's a guy on his porch. The instant I show up, I see that he has a gun in his hand. I order him to drop it, and the first thing he does is turn and start walking away. And my thinking at that point is that I can't shoot this guy in the back, and there's nobody over there that looks to be in danger, so what am I going to do? In the time it takes me to process whether or not I should shoot this guy, he's already turned around and shot me, because my reaction was slower than his action. Action beats reaction every time. That's one mantra that's drilled into our minds. The firearm simulations can play out in a variety of ways, both deadly and peaceful. There's not so much a right or wrong answer to the situation as there's a complex set of factors, some of which, like whether the individual on the porch has a criminal history, may be known to the officer when she enters the scene. At the conclusion, the officer debriefs with her trainer, getting feedback. The exercise isn't all about technique. It's about clear thinking and appropriate reflexes, visual and verbal clues to watch for, possible outcomes, being clear about the appropriate use of deadly force, and finding the words after the fact that will account for the actions you have taken in the urgency of the moment. Simulation is not perfect. Johnson recounts how officers are trained to take a gun from an assailant at close quarters, a maneuver they practice by role-playing with a fellow officer. It requires speed and deftness, striking an assailant's wrist with one hand to break his grip while simultaneously wrestling the gun free with the other. It's a move that officers have been in the habit of honing through repetition. Taking the gun, handing it back, taking it again. Until one of their officers on a call in the field took the gun from an assailant and handed it right back again. In their mutual astonishment, the officer managed to re-seize the gun and hang on to it. The training regime had violated the cardinal rule that you should practice like you play because you will play like you practice. Sometimes the most powerful feedback for calibrating your sense of what you do and don't know are the mistakes you make in the field, assuming you survive them and are receptive to the lesson.